David said before, what we'll be doing, rather than having a Bible reading, we'll be reading selections from those chapters as we work through this morning. It's a long passage to bring us to the end of this little series of life lessons from dark days. You know, Tony Stark had everything that he could wish for. He headed up a massively successful weapons development company, owing its success to his genius in engineering, in technological capability, and he's living up as a result. As a billionaire, doing whatever he wants, until, that is, one day, he visits American forces in Afghanistan to demonstrate his latest devastating weapon, where his own convoy is ambushed by, as it turns out, as the shell lands next to him that nearly kills him, by his own weapons. And living then as a prisoner of terrorists, it gives him time to reflect on what that really means. It was the wake-up call that he needed that changed the direction of his life and leads him to instead to use all his technological genius in a different direction. And so, as perhaps some of you have spotted the name, you know, Iron Man was born, and that's not a real story. if you were unclear until that point. You know, it's been hard work for us to read through these closing chapters of 2 Kings, hasn't it, over the last few weeks? But we want to be those who take the Bible seriously, all of it, and not just the bits that perhaps make us feel better about ourselves. But I trust as that we read of these dark, dark days, perhaps our experience has been a bit like that of Tony Stark, that it's our wake-up call, a wake-up call to see reality, to see human nature, to see ourselves and God's response to our sin more clearly. You see, we've seen that northern nation of Israel carted off into exile, never to return, 722 BC, because of the rampant sin that characterized the nation and its leaders. And all that's left is that little nation of Judah down to the south, still ruled over by the descendants of the great King David's. But they too, they've been spiraling down and down. Despite a couple of really good kings we've met recently, Hezekiah and Josiah, we've also met the very worst of them all. It was Manasseh, who even sacrificed his own sons to the pagan gods. And we're told in chapter 21, verse 16, murdered many innocent people in Jerusalem, until Jerusalem was filled from one end to the other with innocent blood. And although we're reading in these stories of the exploits of the kings, the leaders of God's people, actually, the people of the land were fully on board with the lead that their kings were setting. It wasn't that they were dragged away unwillingly, it was the godly kings who didn't make much difference. They were the ones who didn't make much difference. You know, Josiah did so much that was brilliant as he sought to bring the nation back to God. But actually, it really struck me, I was reading through the book of the prophet Jeremiah in my own Bible readings a few months back. Jeremiah was active all through this period. And what struck me is that you find these blistering denunciations of evil in Jeremiah, but not just from the reigns of the wicked kings, but from the reign of Josiah too. Actually, for all the good stuff that was going on at the top, the rank and file, if you like, were still longing for the pagan worship and all the degenerate living that went along with it. So where does all this end up? It was the end of the road for Israel. What about Judah? Well, let me walk you through Judah's fall, and we'll stop as we go to read parts of those final chapters of 2 Kings. And we're going to pick up the story just 11 years on from where we left off last week. It's about 598 BC now. And in that time, Assyria, who carted Israel off into exile, have fallen as the regional superpower. They've been replaced by Babylon. They're now the regional oppressors, the new oppressors on the block. And the Babylonians have subdued the nation of Judah, where what's left of God's people remains, and they've imposed tributes on the nation. They're having to pay effectively tax to Babylon, about 1,000 miles away. And we're just at the beginning of the reign of King Jehoiakim. The problem for Jehoiakim is that his father, at the very end, towards the end of his reign, decided to rebel against Babylon and to refuse to pay the tributes. And that means that as we come to Jehoiakim's life, we are entering a 3-month reign. And that is all. Because imperial powers like Babylon don't take very kindly to that kind of attitude from their underlings. Let's read chapter 24, verses 10 to 14. During Jehoiakim's reign, the officers of King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon came up against Jerusalem and besieged it. Nebuchadnezzar himself arrived at the city during the siege. Then King Jehoiakim, along with the queen mother, his advisors, his commanders, and his officials, surrendered to the Babylonians. In the 8th year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, he took Jehoiakim prisoner. As the Lord had said beforehand, Nebuchadnezzar carried away all the treasures from the Lord's temple and the royal palace. He stripped away all the gold objects that King Solomon of Israel had placed in the temple. King Nebuchadnezzar took all of Jerusalem captive, including all the commanders and the best of the soldiers, craftsmen, and artisans, 10,000 in all. Only the poorest people were left in the land. So not only is the temple plundered for its treasures, but the cream of Israelite society, those therefore who are most likely to pose a threat to Babylonian rule, are deported to Babylon. We're actually still not at the end, though. There's one more king to go. Zedekiah is set up as king. He's set up as a puppet king by the Babylonians. And so although he's as bad as the rest of them, he actually lasts for 11 years. But actually, his days are numbered, because eventually he too decides to rebel against Babylonian rule, and so the Babylonians come back to finish what they started. Let's read chapter 25 and verses 1 to 12. The last word of chapter 24, Zedekiah rebelled against the king of Babylon. So on January 15th, during the 9th year of Zedekiah's reign, King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon led his entire army against Jerusalem. They surrounded the city and built siege ramps against its walls. Jerusalem was kept under siege until the 11th year of King Zedekiah's reign. By July the 18th, in the 11th year of Zedekiah's reign, the famine in the city had become very severe. The last of the food was entirely gone. Then a section of the city wall was broken down. Since the city was surrounded by the Babylonians, the soldiers waited for nightfall and escaped through the gate between the two walls behind the king's garden. Then they headed toward the Jordan Valley. But the Babylonian troops chased the king and overtook him on the plains of Jericho, for his men had all deserted him and scattered. They captured the king, took him to the king of Babylon at Riblah, where they pronounced judgment upon Zedekiah. They made Zedekiah watch as they slaughtered his sons. Then they gouged out Zedekiah's eyes, bound him in bronze chains, and led him away to Babylon. On August the 14th of that year, which was the 19th year of King Nebuchadnezzar's reign, Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard and an official of the Babylonian king, arrived in Jerusalem. He burned down the temple of the Lord, the royal palace, and all the houses of Jerusalem. He destroyed all the important buildings in the city. Then he supervised the entire Babylonian army as they tore down the walls of Jerusalem on every side. Then Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, took as exiles the rest of the people who remained in the city, the defectors who had declared their allegiance to the king of Babylon and the rest of the population. But the captain of the guard allowed some of the poorest people to stay behind to care for the vineyards and the fields. You know, I don't think this makes anyone's list of top 10 favorite Bible stories, does it? Reading these parts of the Bible just leaves us with a very sober feeling as we face aspects of reality we would probably rather not think about. But what can we take away from it? Well, you know, in many ways, it is just the natural conclusion to what we've been reading in the last few weeks in 2 Kings. If you are going to live without God in his world, if you want to choose evil over God, well, it's never going to end well, is it? You're going to be overtaken by that evil that you've chosen. Find it's not as good as it looks. So we've been sort of seeing that lesson again and again and again, driven home to us over the last few weeks. So it's very clearly there, but I don't want to go over that same ground again. So I just want to highlight one further lesson from this sad passage before finish by looking forward and saying, okay, well, where can we find hope in such a bleak passage as this? Where can we find hope? But before we get to that, the lesson I want to highlight is this. It's the stupidity and the tragedy of sin. Think perhaps back to when you were at school. You guys at JCB, that's not a problem to you. If you can remember back as far as Friday, you're there. Think maybe of the kids at school who were determined to muck around rather than to learn anything. Maybe for some of you, maybe that was you. Whether for whatever reason, perhaps because they cared most about being seen as the cool rebels, or perhaps they just didn't enjoy learning, but they persisted in messing about, disrupting lessons, not caring about the consequences, whether it was detentions or lines or whatever it was, until one day they found themselves with no qualifications and no job. Some of you have struggled with that, haven't you? It's such an obvious outcome when you stop and look at the situation objectively, isn't it? But they just refused to see it because there was something that they cared about so much more. It's not a smart move, is it? But actually, you know, we all do something similar in our own lives at various times. You know, situations where we know that what we're about to do is not going to make anything better, but we so want to do it. We do it anyway. So, maybe it's you get cross at someone. You know that shouting and arguing won't get it anywhere. But the thing is, I'm still holding on to this desperate hope to get my own way somehow. And besides, actually, they've annoyed me, so I don't want to let them off lightly, do I? So I just do it anyway, and I make the whole situation worse. You can think of other kinds of situations. You can think of how you follow through this own stupid logic in your own life, because we all do it. It makes no sense. Why am I saying that from this passage? Well, one of the striking things, one of the features of these chapters here at the end of 2 Kings is that God's people seem to end up losing just about everything that they have gained back at the beginning of the story in 1 Kings. Okay, 1-2 Kings is one story, just your scroll was only so long, so you had to cut it into two. That's why I have 2 books of Kings. You see, we start at the beginning of Kings, just at the death of King David, and into the reign of his son Solomon, where their faithfulness brought so much blessing to the people, so much that they were able to enjoy. So at the beginning of 1 Kings, Israel reaches new heights as they follow God. They had peace from their enemies. They even received tribute from the surrounding nations. They were the ones receiving the tribute. Here, we find them being the ones who have to pay the tributes. First Egypt, they have a little abortive attempt at being regional superpower, then Babylon comes in and takes over. You see that in chapter 24, verse 1. They suffered from marauding bands. There was no peace. People from the nations around them saw their weakness, came in. And so even though under Solomon's reign, we're told that silver was as common in Jerusalem as the stones on the streets, they didn't really rate silver because it was so common. That was the level of their prosperity. Now everything is leached from the nation. The marauding bands come in, take the tribute goes. Then the Babylonians come and take more and more and more. Under Solomon's reign, the land of Israel reached its greatest extent. Now here, they have no territory left at all. Solomon built a stunning palace, built up the city of Jerusalem. Now, chapter 25, verse 9, we read all of that was torn down. And above all, Solomon was the one who gave them the temple, which was so crucial to them. Because it was, if you like, symbolically God's postcode on earth. It was demonstrating physically that God would dwell with them, right at the heart of their national life. That too, torn down there in 25 verse 9. And it's pillaged for its treasures. Do you know, when we read in chapter 24, they took all the gold and silver. And actually, just after our reading in chapter 25, we're told in quite extensive detail, when they came back to finish things off, then they took all the bronze, which we're told when they built the temple was so extensive that they didn't even bother weighing the bronze. They couldn't work out how much they had. It's all gone. So where the thriving capital of David and Solomon had been stands now only this smouldering, semi-deserted ruin. Everything they gained at the beginning of the story, through God's blessing and the king's faithfulness to the covenant, they lose here at the end. That's the stupidity and the tragedy of sin. Because it didn't have to be that way. There's an obvious logic running through Israel's history, played out time and time again before their eyes. Faithfulness to God's covenant brings them blessing. But abandoning God's covenant, putting themselves out of sight of his care, brings trouble and disaster. But that didn't stop the vast majority of Israel plunging headlong down that road. But the key thing is, the lesson for us is not, look how stupid they were, honestly. The lesson for us is, look how stupid sin makes us. Look how stupid sin makes us. They were so committed to living without God, to ignoring him and his laws, that actually it didn't matter how much bad stuff happened as a result. It always seemed to them like that was the obvious thing to do. That was the way to go. Because when we are committed to things that lead us away from God, and we're committed to sin in that way, we too will make stupid decisions that lead us further and further into mess, into the wilderness, the spiritual danger. But to add to the tragedy, it's just so clear from the rest of the Bible that it really didn't have to be this way. There were so many warnings and so many invitations along the way. In the same way that the child who refuses to get on at school is warned and encouraged again and again by their teachers. It was the same for Israel. You know, I had a quick count up in the Bible on my desk this week when I was preparing, and in there's roughly 300 pages of words of the prophets from this period of Israel's history, from the decline and the fall of Israel and Judah. 300 pages. God had told them and told them and told them, but they simply refused to listen. So the application to us is very clear, isn't it? Where is the sin that perhaps you find yourself most tempted by? Where is that leading you? Answer that question for yourself. Who are you listening to? Whose voice is it that it is shaping your life? What's the honest answer to that question? And what will the end result of it all be? You should see here the stupidity and the tragedy of sin. Sit up and pay attention. And so you see, the story of the kings ends in failure. There are no solutions here. So where does that leave us? With the message that humanity is in a hopeless condition, that we can do nothing about it? the knowledge that judgment must fall on our sin eventually. Maybe that would be all we could take away. If perhaps Kings was the only thing we had to go by, the books of Kings. But there is still hope held out for the future. Even in this hopeless state that we have painted so graphically for us, there is no solution for sin yet in the book of Kings. Let's just read the last verses of the book. Chapter 25, verses 27 to 30. In the 37th year of the exile of King Jehoiakim of Judah, evil Merodach ascended to the Babylonian throne. He was kind to Jehoiakim and released him from prison on April 2nd of that year. He spoke kindly to Jehoiakim and gave him a higher place than all the other exiled kings in Babylon. He supplied Jehoiakim with new clothes to replace his prison garb and allowed him to dine in the king's presence for the rest of his life. So the king gave him a regular food allowance as long as he lived. Why do you tack that on the end of your book, I wonder, if you're the writer of Kings? What you've got to hear is the book ends with this tiny little hint of hope. It's only a glimmer, but it's a sign that even now, even after all that has passed, God's kindness has not finished towards his people. This is not the end of the road for God's people. God's kindness has not been exhausted. And so King Jehoiakim, who was the one, you remember, taken prisoner to Babylon, chapter 24, he is honored above all the other exiled kings in Babylon. And with that tiny glimmer of hope, the story ends. Just a little hint that the writer wants us to know this is not the end of the story, that God has not finished in his purposes yet. So you see, on that basis, I suggest that the story of the kings should leave us not just with a hopeless feeling that humanity is hopelessly lost in sin. That is true. It should also leave us longing for a better king for God's people. A deep conviction, we need a better king. We've been down this depressing spiral through the book of Kings, and so often the kings have made things worse, not better. And we need a better leader than that. But even the shining lights in the darkness of these days, even the Hezekiahs and the Josiahs that we've met over the last couple of weeks, they were faithful leaders. They were seeking to lead God's people in right ways. But even they couldn't make any lasting change. They couldn't do it. They weren't up to the job. As soon as they died, the people very quickly reverted to their old ways in such a way that shows that's where their hearts were all along. They just couldn't quite put it into action as they wanted to in the reign of these good kings. We need a better king than a Hezekiah or a Josiah. And that's why in the centuries that followed the disaster of the exile here, which is in 587 BC, the centuries following that, Israel's hopes became pinned so much on a promise of one who is coming, a Messiah, became central to the hopes of God's people. Here, this word Messiah is the Hebrew word Mashiach, which means anointed one. It's a reference to the way that kings were anointed with oil to consecrate them for the task of kingship. So we can helpfully think of this word Messiah and its Greek equivalent in the New Testament, Christos, Christ, as meaning God's promised king. God's promised king. That's what our hopes were pinned on. Because you see, as things got worse and worse, the promises and the prophets actually became stronger and stronger, that something better would come, that someone better would come. You see, with the days of two kings gone, the land was left in the hands of governors. And the next king from King David's family would look very, very different. He came along about 600 years later. He never ruled over a nation state, But he has changed the world. His name is Jesus. So we don't look to our political leaders to make everything right. We aren't looking to our political leaders to sort out our hearts. Their role is important, but so, so limited. Let me assure you that leaving the EU is neither the solution to all our problems, nor is it a sign of everything that is wrong with us. It is far more limited than that. Our real problems lie far, far deeper, with things that our politicians cannot touch. You see, we need a better king, not just one who is the perfect leader, but who's even able to transform his people, to change his people in ways that the best human leaders never could do. That's the only place where our hope lies. Because Israel in the Old Testament, they had everything else that you could give them. They had God's own law given to them. They had a land, a fertile land in which to enjoy it and to live out this good way of life that God had given to them. They were given it all on a plate, and this is where it ended. We need something better. We need a better king. That is where our hope lies. You see, only Jesus has provided a real solution to the problem of our sinfulness which caused all that. Only he can change the direction of my life and of yours. And here's just one of the promises God made at that time. It's from the prophet Ezekiel. Ezekiel was one of those carted off into exile in Babylon and served as a prophet to the community in exile there. Here's one of God's promises through him from chapter 36 of his book. Then God says, I will sprinkle clean water on you and you will be clean. Your filth will be washed away. You will no longer worship idols, and I will give you a new heart. I'll put a new spirit within you. I'll take out your stony, stubborn heart and give you a tender, responsive heart instead. That is where our hope lies. We look at such dark days. We see what happens to humanity when they're given everything needed to succeed. It ends here in 2 Kings chapter 25. But God has not finished in 2 Kings 25. He promises a better king. So I hope that 2 Kings will be to us a little like Tony Stark's bomb. Seeing the reality of the situation for what it is will cause us to take stock and to turn away from that rather than plunging headlong into disaster anyway. I pray it will awaken us to the reality of our predicament without Jesus, to the foolishness, to the danger of our sin. But more than that, I hope it causes us to pursue a life as disciples of Jesus with greater conviction, greater passion, because we've seen that much more clearly how much all our hopes lie on him and the salvation that he brings, and that alone. He is the king we really need, and he is the only one who can bring the change, the transformation that alone can turn around our lives. Let's look to him. Spend a few moments in quiet as we just reflect on God's word to us.